You're listening to Decoding Healthcare Innovation with Carrie Nixon and Rebecca Gwilt, a podcast for novel and disruptive business leaders seeking to transform how we receive and experience healthcare. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Decoding Healthcare Innovation. My name is Caitlin O'Connor, and I'm going to be guest hosting this episode with my colleague, Rima Taneja. I'm senior counsel at Nixon Gwilt Law. Rima is counsel, and we've been working together on building a veterinary telehealth or telepet practice within our firm. We're really excited to be here. We've got a really exciting guest to share with you as well. But before we kind of dive into the substantive topic, Rima, do you want to sort of kick us off and set the stage?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Caitlin. And hi, everyone. I'm Rima, as Caitlin mentioned. So today we'll be talking about veterinary telehealth, or telepet, as we call it. As we all know, telehealth has exploded in recent years due to the COVID-19 public health emergency, although it has been around for a number of years. Similarly, telepet is also currently growing at a rapid pace. However, many states are not yet aligned with each other regarding what services can be provided virtually and what needs to happen before telepet can be provided. So during this podcast, we will be speaking with an expert and leader in the telepet space to talk to us about how telepet has evolved, what challenges currently exist, and what stakeholders can do to help move the needle along to expand access to telepet services. Back to you, Caitlin.
Thank you. Yeah, so when Rima and I first got started in this space, we just started reaching out to a bunch of people, trying to learn who we should be talking to, where we should be, what was happening, and just trying to get a sense of the overall landscape. And everyone we talked to and everywhere we looked, without fail, the same name kept coming up as the person to talk to in this space, the absolute expert. So I am really excited that we are actually joined by this person today. And so if everyone will please welcome the founder of the Animal Policy Group, author of Pet Nation, The Love Affair That Changed America, and all-around telepet policy guru, Mark Cushing. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Caitlin. Thanks, Rima. Nice to join you two excellent lawyers, and good to see lawyers taking the lead on this topic. So look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. And we know you're a lawyer too. So I started off, I mentioned like a fraction of the many hats that you wear. So can you kick us off by just telling us a little bit more about your background and your current work and how you got to where you are today?
Happy to. I'll try to be brief. So I'm a former business litigator. I tried a lot of cases in Portland, Oregon, and around the West for the first 12 years of my career. And then I noticed that we were moving towards mediation and settlement and arbitration, and nothing like having 12 anonymous jurors sitting in a jury box, which is what I love. So I made a transition as I had success getting someone elected governor in Oregon. And it pulled me into the political realm. And as all political roots do, it ended up in Washington, D.C., where I was a partner in what's now a large international law firm, and got a phone call as I was boarding a flight in Ottawa, Canada, because I was mainly representing Canadian interests in the U.S. And it was from the founder of Banfield Pet Hospitals, still the largest pet hospital group in the world. Then owned partly by Mars, now owned 100% by Mars, Inc., as part of the Mars Veterinary Health Organization. And this coalition that's never been reassembled, because I'm not sure everybody gets along well enough to be in a coalition, was involved in an issue about microchipping of pets, which seems like decades ago. And the U.S. is still not exactly a leader in that field. And with my team, I made significant progress in solving the problem through Congress, and figured I was done. It was fun, a good fee. You know, lawyers enjoy moving on to the next challenge. And then my phone started ringing from animal health interests and veterinary interests, animal welfare groups. And sometimes success fools people into thinking you're talented and they should use you for something else. So I was a beneficiary of that. That was back in 2006. Since then, I've built now what's called the Animal Policy Group. I have a team of eight that work with me. We're all virtual. And we basically focus on regulatory and legal issues, not as a traditional law firm like yourselves. I'm not saying you're traditional, but you're a law firm as such. So I'm the only lawyer in the group. Focus on regulatory issues involving the industry, which are primarily in the states. The federal government, thankfully, has not paid much attention to veterinary or pet related issues. And I'm not encouraging that, though it might increase my business, but I think it's good as is. Also very involved in building industry coalitions like the Veterinary Innovation Council, which I formed with the leader of the NAVC group in 2016, which kicked off telemedicine for the veterinary space. And then the Veterinary Virtual Care Association, which I started with a good friend in the early stages of COVID to try to build a smaller, but a veterinary version of the American Telemedicine Association. Because like a lot of things, a lot of issues, I've spent 15 years now looking at human healthcare and wondering why we don't adapt successful models to veterinary care. Telemedicine being the first. The other one that's very important that I'm actively involved in right now are creating mid-level professionals like PAs or nurse practitioners, which perhaps sometime we'll talk about. So through all that, I've built a lovely stable of clients across the veterinary, animal health, pet if you will, sector, both pharmaceutical, nutrition, practices, and so forth, and do not the scope of work that your firm does with clients, but really focus on, you know, Veterinary Practice Act, state veterinary medical boards with whom I've built extensive relations over the years, state veterinary medical associations, which are kind of the policy making advocacy bodies inside the states, as this sector has become sexy and interesting from a backwater, if I can say so, you know, 16 years ago. And that was the subject of my book, Pet Nation. So that's me. And I have three Bengal cats, which qualifies me as crazy. Nobody has three Bengals, if you know what that breed does. And a little Papillon puppy. So I kind of practice what I preach a little bit. There you go.
Love that. I'm waiting for my copy of Pet Nation to come in. I was going to try to read it before we talked today, but Amazon was being slow this weekend, unfortunately.
Yeah, I hope it's demand for my book. But anyway, appreciate you.
I'm sure it is.
I hope you enjoy it. It's chock full of facts that hopefully will help you in your practice.
I'm looking forward to it. All right, Reema, I think you're up first with a question.
Yes. So let's dive in. So Mark, as we know, you've been in this space for a while since the beginning. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you saw Telepet being implemented at the start and where it is now, how it's evolved, how the services changed? What does that look like to you?
Great question. Human medicine, while it has a huge federal overhang, obviously with Medicare, Medicaid, HHS, and all the above, it's regulated at a state level in terms of what doctors can and can't do. For the most part, there's exceptions, right? And so to start with, you know, when I looked at that, it was driven by a Wall Street Journal article in January of 2015. The headline was, "Your smartphone will see you now." I read the article. I think there were 50 paragraphs, and I tried to see if any paragraph couldn't apply to veterinary medicine. And there wasn't one. There was no rationale that the veterinary medicine couldn't adopt telemedicine, particularly the origin of human healthcare telemedicine, which were states like Kentucky and Oklahoma with significant rural populations that simply couldn't access care. So why not use existing technology to link a doctor with a patient like we're linking ourselves today, being in three different, you know, parts of the country. So we got started. And I knew it'd be state by state, but you had to build the rationale. And the group, the Veterinary Innovation Council, was formed not just to look at this, but took that on as its first issue. A diverse group included a former AVMA president, a current dean of Texas A&M, and other industry leaders. And we quickly reached a consensus that it made sense. And the issue, which I'm sure we'll talk about, that is the divisive issue or the hot issue, it still is, sadly, 6 years later, is a question of, can you begin a relationship with a pet and their pet owner or parent the same way you can in the human space between a doctor and the patient? Can you begin that relationship through a remote but live engagement? And there were strong feelings then and now by the leading trade association in veterinary medicine, which is the American Veterinary Medical Association, the AVMA. And they then felt and have since reaffirmed it that no, you have to have an in-person visit. Presumably the pet's in your clinic, on your exam table, you can look at it, touch it, do whatever you want. Well, these were the same issues that human healthcare dealt with. And there was a battery of folks, which is why it took 20 years in some cases to get states to adopt a view that no, that's one way to do it. And maybe it's a good way to do it. I'm not challenging that, but there are, you can use a remote engagement, particularly when the in-person contact isn't realistic. It's not going to happen. So aren't we better? And that, I've always made that argument. And I use the example of, you know, having been in DC for a long time, I don't live there now. But I remember the apartments in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside the DC border. And picture, a 75-year-old woman on the eighth floor of an apartment with two cats. She is never going to go under her bed, pull the cats out, suffer the scratches, put them in cages, walk to the elevator, go downstairs, get a cab, get an Uber, go to a clinic. So are we better off that she receives no veterinary medical guidance for the care of her cats? So because she can't have an in-person visit. And I've never heard anyone, I've had people attempt to, but I've never heard anyone make a credible argument why that would be the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, and as a trial lawyer, you pick examples that are somewhat extreme that corner your opponent to make sure they can't disagree with you. But on that one, there was pretty broad consensus. So that issue has been the heart, Caitlin and Rima, of the debate for now 6 years. So the Veterinary Innovation Council, the first thing we did, we had a chance to speak to the collection of all the state veterinary boards in the country. There's an organization, AAVSB, annual meeting, and actually AVMA had a representative and one other person and myself, and we debated the topic. And then we sat with the members for an afternoon of workshops about the issue. And my table was swamped, you know, not because I was some, you know, rock star, but because I had taken the view that and made the case why it made sense. Not to replace in-person visits when that's realistic and practical or if that's the preference of the pet owner, but allowing at least a person to begin a relationship. And it was always anchored in one principle. And I know you've seen that in human healthcare. That principle is the veterinarian, she has to make a judgment that she's comfortable beginning a relationship virtually, FaceTime, Zoom, whatever it might be. If she says, you know what, I can't see your pet or I can't see enough of your pet, I'm not comfortable, conversation's over as far as beginning to provide medical care. So the AAVSB, as well as our Innovation Council, anchor the viewpoint with that proviso, that the veterinarian has to be comfortable. But once you've done that, and by the way, the patient has to be, the pet owner has to be comfortable. If they begin talking to you and say, you know what, I want to come in and see you, conversation's over. That's fine. So it's actually a negotiated agreement, which frankly I like because it gets the pet owner more engaged in how serious and important veterinary care is rather than just take it for granted. So that debate has continued for 6 years. The number of people that favor adoption in the veterinary space of the human model, which obviously I'm on that side, has grown and grown and grown. But because of the scope and reach of the American Veterinary Medical Association, we only have seven states out of the 50 states plus DC, so the 51 jurisdictions. I'm not calling for the DC statehood here. I'm just pointing out that we there are pets inside DC. We only have seven states where the VCPR, the veterinary client patient relationship, may be created virtually. That's going to grow, but I wish I could say to you two, it's going to grow in a hurry because it takes one state after another. And there's a core group, and there's different reasons why, and we can talk about that, but there's a core group that say kind of hell no to that. And so that's where we are. Let me just stop there. That's a long answer to a really good question.
I was just going to say that's very insightful. And I think the key here is that many industry folks who might not be on board yet are forgetting that veterinary telehealth or, you know, human telehealth is not meant to serve as a replacement for right. in-person care, rather a supplement to when it's right. not realistic or reasonable or doesn't make sense. You know, especially given the example that you mentioned of an elderly pet owner who might not be able to get themselves to the veterinary practice, or I think especially in cases of emergency care where sometimes pet owners think their pet is suffering from an emergency, you get on a telehealth consultation, it might be the case that there are other options and then they don't have to go to the emergency room and wait for hours and hours. So yeah, I think that's definitely a great perspective.
Well, yeah, and you have right now twin issues, and they're not mirrors of each other, but they're first cousins, if not family members, one being access to care. And that tends to become an issue for lower income or rural or diverse Americans over here. And you have the shortage right now that's acute, it's chronic, of veterinarians. And so how do those two relate? Well, the fewer veterinarians, right, obviously, the fewer clinic openings are for somebody to bring in their pet. And just talk to anybody right now with a pet in this country, rural, suburban, urban, doesn't matter, east, west, north, south, wherever you are, you're being told, can't see you right now, can't see you today, maybe see you in 2 days. I know a CEO of a major pet-related company, global company, who couldn't get his dog in his community for 4 days. I mean, I told him that's impossible. I mean, you know, not that you get special privileges, but you obviously know how to work the veterinary system. So what a tool telemedicine is to simply get you in touch with a professional to talk about what's going on, where they can look and see your pet. And that professional could be a veterinarian if you want true medical advice and care. It could be a vet tech or vet nurse if you just want some information. You want to talk to somebody that, you know, understands dogs, let's say, and knows eating behavior and so forth, and might explain to you what could be going on with your pet. So that's the shortage side. The access to care is, if you're not able to get to a veterinarian, if you haven't had a relationship and they're not taking new clients, and we hear that all the time in other fields, psychiatric and others, sorry, we're just not taking new patients. The VCPR is no good to you. I mean, it's to say, get inside and see a vet, I've tried, can't get in. So why wouldn't you use the providing of advice and opening the possibility of care to a vet who says, I want to do that, I'm happy. By the way, a lot of vets work from home. They actually want to do this. Why not expand that and make that normal? And I'd love to get to this topic, so I'll kick it off to you. We have the benefit of a perfect laboratory, an actual laboratory of 4 years of allowing telemedicine, the telemedicine VCPR in Ontario, you know, the province in Canada that has Toronto just north of Michigan. 15 million people, fifth largest state in the U.S. if it were in the United States, very sophisticated, love pets the same way anybody in Michigan does or the rest of the country. And they've not had a single complaint. I've shared this with you too when we met. There's not been a single complaint filed with the governing body in Ontario from any pet owner of harm to their pet due to telemedicine. So I've asked the question of all the vet med boards in this country and have not received one example. So I don't want to hear the theoretical, you know, hypothetical, you know, fears yeah. without saying, well, let's just actually look at the data. And we have one place with 4 years of data. They legalized it in June of 18, very carefully worked it up since 2014. They've expanded it. Veterinarians support it. Pet owners like it. It's not hurt practice revenues, which is the underlying fear that many opponents have. I'm going to lose money. Okay, that's fair. No veterinarian should support something where they think they're going to maybe cut their own income. I'm not, you know, promoting that idea. But guess what? It doesn't work that way. So is there some difference at the Canadian border? I don't think so. I don't think people in bad climates like telemedicine and good climates don't. So,
yeah. I think that it's really interesting because when you first shared that example about Ontario, I was surprised. I hadn't even heard of it. And all of the things that you're talking about remind me a lot of the same conversations that we have in human telemedicine. And it's all sort of, that's why I think it's so important that we keep drawing that parallel and looking at those different examples, because it's so poignant, right? Like in human telemedicine, we talk about access to care all the time. We talk about the rural patients that don't have access to providers very easily. And so they wait until they're in an emergent situation. And then the emergency rooms become overcrowded because that's the only place for people to go when they need care. And the same thing happened to me last year. I was in the veterinary emergency room for probably like 8 hours for something that didn't end up being emergent, but I didn't know. And I couldn't get a hold of my vet and my dog was acting very sick. So my only option was to go to the emergency room and sit there for 8+ hours during a pandemic when I don't really want to be in an overcrowded space anyway. So we ended up sitting in my car for 8 hours, which is just uncomfortable. But so I think those parallels are so important. And it kind of brings me to my next question, which is similar to, I think, what you're getting at, which is like, what are the current challenges? Because we've seen a lot of challenges we overcome in human telehealth when it comes to, you know, the government starting to act at the federal level to reduce some of the restrictions around telehealth. And sort of some of those same conversations. And so I'm interested, one of the things that you mentioned at the beginning of the call as well is companies like Banfield and Mars, who are these really large players, actually supporting telehealth or getting into the telehealth space. I actually think that's very different than human telehealth. That's the one area where I think it sort of diverges, where at the beginning, the large players in human telehealth weren't actually very interested in adopting this new technology. So I'm interested, as we draw those parallels, like what are some of the challenges that you see and maybe some of the differences where we have actually more opportunity in veterinary telehealth to move it forward more quickly than we have on the human telehealth side?
Well, we kicked off the discussion after a slow 3 or 4 years during COVID. So COVID spotlighted the need. And many states, 19, had emergency orders that lifted the in-person VCPR requirement. So that became another set of laboratories, right? And so we've looked at those states. Again, same question. Any problems, any harm to pets, any injuries, or God forbid, any deaths to pets? Not any. So it's hard to make the case that it doesn't fit with pets. In the legislative battle we have underway in Michigan, you know, a member of the House committee asked a very simple question: if it works for people and it's legal for people, why not pets? And there's no rationale. And because if somebody quickly said, well, pets can't talk, we have this thing called pediatric medicine, and one-year-olds can't self-diagnose a lung or a heart or a urinary issue and so forth. So come on. And Pediatric Society strongly endorses and has published reports on the value of telemedicine for human pediatric patients. So that's number one. But here are the challenges. We do have now large practices endorsing telemedicine. The sponsors of the VVCA include Mars. But when the largest trade association, the largest body of organized veterinary medicine, the AVMA, opposes it as strongly and frankly defiantly as they do this one issue, it makes it hard. It puts companies at some risk, not legal risk, but it's awkward for them to be opposed to the national body. Now, we know as lawyers how little attention individual lawyers pay to the American Bar Association. No offense, ABA, but you don't really pop up every day and nobody stops and thinks, how does the ABA feel about this? Unless it's even changed now as far as their opinion about a Supreme Court judge. It used to really matter how the ABA reacted to a nominee. That's even less important, if totally unimportant now. But the AVMA is powerful. Now, they have their reasons for opposing it. I'm not going to challenge the reasons. I just think the conclusion's wrong. But that is the primary challenge, alongside one other that's very practical. In a period of acute shortages, which means you don't have enough staff, which means the people working in your clinic don't get breaks. They work long days. They don't get time off. They feel the pressures. They see people waiting to get in, and they have to say to them, you can't. And none of them went to vet school to tell people you can't get care for your pet. And it really hits veterinarians hard. And it's a profession already singled out as having the highest suicide rate of any profession in the country, partly because veterinarians on a weekly basis deal with something called euthanasia. They've cared for a pet for 10 years, and unlike a human doctor, have to actually manage the process of saying, we're putting your cat down. You know, and nobody does that with a thick skin and goes home and forgets about it. So you add all those factors up. And there are a lot of veterinarians that have shared with me, you know, Mark, I don't have any time to think about telemedicine. I don't really know how to do it. I don't have any extra staff that volunteered to be technology wizards. Now, there's an answer to that. You can outsource it, which is the case in human medicine, the same in telemedicine. You know, your law firm, myself, we represent various telemedicine providers. But even then, you've got to take some time. You've got to vet them. You've got to decide which of the five that want your business and all those issues. I get it. So and that's not an excuse as much as just a real world practical impediment. So, you know, I work on both challenges. I work on the shortage of veterinarians all day, every day right now. And that connects to telemedicine, but I'm just, you know, that's really been a very keen focus of mine. And that needs to get solved along the way. But part of it is, as you both know, you can start small. You know, you don't have to transform your practice. You don't have to get a new software system. You know, all those things that would make you go, oy vey, you know, please, you know, go to the clinic down the street, you know, leave me alone. You don't have to do that. But that's a real world problem. So I think we've got to get, you know, we've got a program coming up at the AVMA conference in 2 weeks in Philadelphia. This isn't sponsored by AVMA, but they've kindly made space available. And we're putting on a 3-hour program to really give people the first look at what, tell us how it worked in Ontario, Canada. Bring the woman down. She's a government employee. She has no stake in any company. She's not making money off telemedicine. She just manages the process. Her name's Jan Robinson, and she's going to spend an hour just explaining how it worked. I think when people hear that, they're going to go, there's nothing about that experience that wouldn't apply in my state. So yeah. I told Jan, get ready for some consulting contracts because you're going to be asked to come into, I hope, a lot of states and talk about it. Then we're going to bring in two platform companies that are telemedicine providers and just take questions from the audience. How does it work? How do I start with you? What do you do? Tell me you're legal. Prove to me you're not doing something unethical. All those suspicions, cover that. And then our Virtual Care Association, the co-chairs and founders with me, but those two are going to present the model telemedicine regulations that we favor, which have protections built in, as you two know, that the states like New Jersey and Michigan are currently employing. You know, there's no state that just says, do whatever the hell you want. We don't care. Try not to hurt anybody. You know, so then you reassure people. And I think getting that, we'll get it broadcast hopefully, and then, you know, streamed and do all the things you can do to have people just watch this and see if it doesn't, you know, calm you down and give you some confidence. So
yeah, that's excellent information. So keeping these challenges in mind, so we know VCPR is a roadblock. We know the AVMA is also has its opposing views. So what would you recommend for stakeholders who are in this industry and trying to expand access to telepet? How would you recommend that they advocate for expansion, and what can they do to help move the needle along?
I think a couple of things, you know, and part of it is having firms like your own involved in the work that I do. But number one, be active in the 7 states that allow it. And build up experience and expertise in those states that become, as you know, reference points. There's no law in America in any state that doesn't begin with one state. And then people go, wow, California, usually it's California doing something that half the country thinks is outrageous and the other half thinks is not a bad idea. But the point is, you start somewhere and then you build. And so number one is take advantage of the 7 states and build up expertise and comfort where their regulators can say, you know what, this works the same way Jan Robinson from Ontario is gonna say. That's number one. Then you need to have the organized retention of law firms, regulatory advocates, lobbyists like myself and our firm, get engaged as we're engaged right now in Michigan, for example. where the Michigan VMA is trying to undo their progressive board laws. And we, you know, and it could have happened and easily would have happened, but for us getting involved. So you've got to get your, you know, hands dirty, so to speak, not illegally, but just you've got to get into the political process. This is not, to its credit, a highly political profession, veterinary medicine. They've existed for years outside the realm of much political attention. Nobody ran for the legislature in any state to fix veterinary medicine. So it's kind of been a
side. I would vote for them if they did. If somebody in Virginia ran on that platform, I'd vote for them in a heartbeat.
It's changing right now, Caitlin. Yeah. You're right. It is changing with frankly, the whole phenomenon of Pet Nation. Little plug for my book there, but that's true. People care a lot more about those issues. But you've got to get engaged in the political process. And you don't have what you have in human healthcare. You don't have major companies that have bankrolls to say, we'll hire lobbyists because it's not inexpensive. Things don't happen fast. So telling a veterinary company, it's going to take 2 or 3 years, it's going to cost you X amount of money a month, you're going to get roughed up, you're going to be called names, you're going to have your motives, you know, called into question. You know, the political process, particularly right now, is no place that probably anybody wants to dive into. But that's how it changes. And we won't really have federal law being our beneficiary here or being our ally. So it's going to have to take the pressure of shortages, access to care, examples of how it works for people to say this makes no sense to fight it. And I always tell people, any practice that doesn't want to use it, don't use it. Don't worry. Yeah. Don't use it. Just tell people we don't do that. You don't even have to tell people where to go. Just say we don't do that. So I think over time, and I've already seen it in the 2 years that Virtual Care Association has been in effect, I've seen temperatures lower. I've seen people say, you're right. We'll try it when we get some time and have some room to maneuver right now. So, but I think you've got to understand it, Rima, to your question. So real quickly, understand it, use it where it's legal. Tell the story about it. Get involved in your own state VMA saying, take a look at this. Don't just listen to what you're being told, the ideology should or shouldn't be. Actually talk to vets to try it. And that was the case in Michigan. We had some very impressive veterinarians that hadn't used it before COVID that basically came in and testified that, you know what, my practice would have died but for telemedicine. And now I can't stop using it because my clients like it. It's so convenient. And, you know, right now with the price of gas, with all the challenges, the idea of going to a vet clinic and waiting, which was never a happy experience, right? You've got a cat, you've got three dogs in the chairs next to you, your cat's going completely berserk, the dogs are stressed out. I mean, there's reasons why millennials have said continually they'd rather manage the care of their pets remotely unless it absolutely is critical to go in to see the veterinarian. That's illogical. That's not some extreme view. Those are real pet owners saying it's just not a fun experience, let alone trying to find the time, let alone now trying to find a vet that can see me. So you add all that up. Well, we had a good example, Atlantic Monthly, you know, a large national magazine, you know, mainstream media. They hate to be called mainstream, but I think they are. And they ran the story last week about we don't have enough veterinarians to take care of America's pets. Huge coverage in the veterinary space. I mean, I have people blast me with this article. Cushing, can you believe what we just saw? I said, you know, amen, sister. That's great. Because now it's, you know, it's the Washington Post, it's New York Times, it's Wall Street Journal. I mean, they're talking about this. And that changes it for people. You know, it's not just an insular veterinarian's issue. And that just gets to the other point. Human healthcare has experimented so successfully with innovations that are driven by one factor. Give people the style and form and means of having healthcare that they want.
Yes.
I mean, that seems like an obvious idea, but it's not. Well, in the veterinary space, it's always been shaped by how do veterinarians want to practice veterinary medicine. All the models from 1970s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, all of that, the vet school curricula, it's all focused on a veterinarian-centric model of healthcare. And nobody cared. And then all of a sudden that blew up. All of a sudden millennials became the biggest players at the table. They own more pets along with Gen Zs than anybody. And they're like, you see this thing called my smartphone? That's how my world works for everything. And don't tell me when I get the pets, I have to turn off my phone. So, you know, I mean, and there's that happening too. And you know, the idealist in me says at some point, all these things converge. We get to 15 states. Now we're approaching half of them. But I'm going to tell you something. It's hand-to-hand combat beyond the first seven. It really is. So it's we're not home free by any stretch.
Yeah, I think that this is, you know, this sort of to kind of round out the conversation, one of the things that we talk about with our clients all the time, I'm sure you talk about with your clients, and we actually are still having these conversations on the human side of healthcare as well, which is if you want to be a successful business in this space, you have to be willing to take risk.
Yeah.
Things are changing very slowly, and we need companies to be willing to take some of that risk, collect the data, maybe, you know, go out into Ontario, collect that data, come into the US and do it the right way so that we can show other states how successful telehealth can be for in the veterinary space. But that doesn't come without risk because, like you said, even in Michigan, where the board has been more progressive, they're now walking that back. And so, or trying to. And so, you know, even when we think things are moving in one direction, there are going to be roadblocks or bumps along the way that you've got to be prepared to handle and manage those risks sort of accordingly. So yeah, I think this has been really helpful. I think it's a really, this is just kind of scratching the surface of everything we could talk about in this conversation. But I really appreciate you sharing your perspective. I think that, you know, hopefully some of these challenges, like you said, are things that we're going to be addressing over the next couple of years, and we'll all be working together to do that.
Happy to collaborate, and I'm optimistic, but you know, it's just measured by, you can take 50 issues in our lifetimes, mine longer than yours so far, I'm sure, of where you just watch how it goes slow. And then the pace just picks up, and then suddenly people go, why don't we do this? Why did it take us so long to shift, you know, on so many social issues? So I think we'll get there. And part of it's generational, honestly. So,
ways, I hope that the public health emergency has been a little bit of a sort of Kickstarter for veterinary telehealth and for other forms of technology in the human healthcare space, where now that we've gotten a taste of it, like now that I have a veterinarian and a vet tech that I can access, I have an app on my phone. I use Pop. I don't know if anybody is familiar with it, but now that I have that app. So now that I have that app and I can access a veterinarian through my phone, I want that. Like, I don't want to go back to the old way of doing things where the toothpaste is out of the tube, or, you know, all of those sayings that people say. We're heading down that path already, and I don't think there's much going back. So I'm optimistic as well. I'm glad to hear that you are. As we wrap up the conversation, I want to make sure you get a chance to tell people where they can buy Pet Nation. Also, if you want to share the VVCA website and the VIC website, I think all of those are important resources for our listeners. So, let us know that, and then maybe let's start planning our next conversation.
Love to do that. So Pet Nation, you can get it, you know, online, obviously through Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and the usual places. There's a paperback, which is slightly updated to the original, which wisely has a cat. It's a graphic cover, not a pictorial cover, and it has a cat, not just a dog. Friends of mine have pointed that out. That was a little slow to learn there. Number one, Veterinary Virtual Care Association is VVCA.org, and it has a map that a lot of people use daily, which explains to you in every state what the law is and how things work. Animal Policy Group, my organization, is just animalpolicygroup.com. It's a mouthful, but if you can spell it right one time, you can go from there. And you had another suggestion. I don't think I mentioned it. What was
that? I think I mentioned VIC, the Veterinary Innovation Council.
VeterinaryInnovationCouncil.org. And that's part of the largest media and continuing education group in the country called NAVC. And that's that, or this right now we're taking on access to care and really diving into access to care. So each year or two, Vic takes a new issue by itself and says, let's just hone in on that for some time. The last one was vet techs and creating mid-level professionals, which has led to the opening next month of the first veterinary version of a mid-level professional at the Lincoln Memorial College of Veterinary Medicine, which is a client of mine in East Tennessee, very innovative school. So, you know, these things lead to change, you know, and now more than one school is looking because Lincoln Memorial shared their curriculum with everybody and said, here, take a look at it. It's a pilot. Wow. We're going to tell you how it works. And so that's really, and that's going to be the spirit of telemedicine. It's just to just keep sharing with people until they look at it and go, all right, I give up. You're right. Let's see if we can try it. So good luck to you two. And we'll find ways to collaborate. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Yes, for sure. Thank you so much, Mark. We really appreciate it.
Okay. We'll see you.